Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The Executive Director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this continuing conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Well, thank you, Agnes, and welcome to this Tuesday edition of the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Today is Tuesday. It is the 22nd day of September in the year 2020. It is a pleasure to be with you today. I was unable to do a program yesterday, and I also have to announce that we're going to have to suspend today's program after the first hour because I have a medical appointment at 2:30. So a half hour from then. So I'm going to have to end the program after 1 hour today and then make tracks in order to get there by the 2:30 appointment. But that for me, that's bad news. I missed yesterday, and then to have to cut today's program in half really disturbs me. But there's a bright side to this, to the beginning of the program today, and that is that tomorrow we're going to have Kevin Shanley back. And I know that many of you look forward to Kevin Shanley as I do. And he sent me an article that he wrote last week, and it just blew my mind. And I didn't know anything about it. So it's about China, obviously, because I mean that's his focus. And there's a lot of things going on with China that I wanted to raise. The president, for example, our president, gave an address this morning to the United Nations. And it's usually, as the media said, it's usually a big deal because all the nations are together there and all of that. But because this was done virtually, it kind of loses its pizzazz, if you know what I mean, especially for Trump. Because without the audience, without being able to feed off the crowd, he's pretty sad. But he did say something this morning, and the bulk of it was aimed at China. And it was really heavy against China. And knowing what I know about some of the things that Kevin Shanley is going to say tomorrow, I want to raise this question with Kevin tomorrow, because Kevin is going to be sharing with us what China's saying about us. And after I read the article that Kevin wrote, it dawned on me that I don't know how long we can postpone military action here. This is getting very, very bad and very serious. And we do not have the man in the White House that can handle this or deal with this. And for him to continue to provoke in the face of what's happening. And I'm sure that our intelligence people are aware of some of the things that Kevin's going to tell us tomorrow. Maybe not all of them, but some of them. So I really encourage you to turn in tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to it. And I mentioned to my brother last night on the telephone that that Kevin was going to be on Wednesday, and he got all excited. And he said, oh, man, he's great. I just love to hear him. So he learned so much. And that's exactly right, because Kevin's talking about a part of the world that most of us know very, very little about. And so it's just a learning. It's just 2 hours of constant learning for me, and I kind of suspect for the people who tune in as well. So I'm looking forward to that. So that'll be tomorrow, the full 2 hours. And as I mentioned, today we're going to have to suspend at the end of the first hour. But first of all, I want to make sure that everybody has the 800 number, because if you would be so inclined to join us on the air and share your thoughts with us. And the first thing I'm going to talk about in a moment is the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as I think everybody else is talking about. So, you know, if you are inclined to come on the air and share your thoughts with us, it can be on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, on her death, on the struggle over filling the vacancy on the court, whatever it would be. By all means, you are welcome. And the same invitation extends every single day. Tomorrow, I'm going to ask you to hold off and let Kevin do his thing. Especially if you're calling about something else. But the 800 number will be open tomorrow. If you would like to chat with Kevin, then by all means, you're invited to do that. I think Kevin would love that. But if you're like me, I'd rather hear Kevin than myself, if that makes sense. So anyway, the 800 number is 844-THE-HORN. 844-THE-HORN. And if you dial that number, it'll get you into the Head-On Studios. Agnes is there, and she'll get you on the air immediately. So, you know, if you'd be inclined to do that today, then by all means, feel free to do it. But I did want to mention the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I think the nation is in mourning. I think the only people that aren't in mourning are the 53 Republican members of the United States Senate, and possibly a few Republican members of the House that think the same way. But to be very honest with you, I've run across comments from a lot of people who are Republicans who have expressed sorrow and sympathy and condolences on the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Because it seems to me, and this is something that it's very hard to do in life. I think Elijah Cummings did it. I think John Lewis did it. And I really believe that Ruth Bader Ginsburg did it as well. And that's to rise above politics. I think that what I've picked up is evidence that a number of people in this country who are political, and consequently one would expect to be on the other side when it comes to the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, have expressed condolences and concerns for her death. Because I think thinking people, whatever their ideological preference, recognize that this woman had literally gone beyond politics. I mean, many of the things she did obviously benefited, you know, were on the liberal side of the spectrum, no question. But the way she did it and the credit that she brought to the Supreme Court of the United States, I don't think that there's another justice on the court right now who at the same point in their lives, which is the end of their lives, we would be able to say the same thing about anybody else but her. I think what she's done is testament to the quality of this woman and the degree to which she loved this nation, and she loved and respected the people in this nation. And she did everything that she could do to protect, preserve, and keep this nation on course. When we woke up yesterday morning and my wife heard the news Saturday morning that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died Friday evening, she cried. I will say that. She cried. And she sat on the edge of the bed and said, and this is seared in my memory. She sat there with her hands over her face, and shook her head back and forth and said, oh, God, why couldn't she have lived just 2 more months? Just 2 more months. And I was so moved when I heard that. And so I'll never forget those words. I mean, I just found them so powerful. Now we're in the political battle of the first major, I think, major political battle of the 21st century. Because the Republicans, President Trump and his Republican sycophants, acolytes, whatever you want to call them, because they all fall in line. With the exception of two people this time, but are trying to basically permanently enhance their power within the court. In other words, they're doing Jamel Bowie in today's New York Times wrote a beautiful piece, absolutely wonderful piece. I'm going to spend time on it when we have more time next week, because I thought the piece was that powerful. Because it includes a lot of history on the history of the Supreme Court. And what Bowie points out is that what's going on right now with an effort to kind of ram through a replacement while Donald Trump is still president before the election is a raw exercise of political power. It is an exercise of raw power. And there is serious, hopefully I can say likelihood. I was going to say possibility, but I hope it's more than a possibility. I hope it's a likelihood that Donald Trump is going to lose on November 3rd or some days after that when the mail-in votes are counted. But I really do believe that what's going on now is going to cost a number of Republicans their seats as well. Which means it's beginning to look like the Republicans are going to lose control of the United States Senate. Donald Trump is saying, and Mitch McConnell are saying, that when vacancies occur on the Supreme Court, it usually energizes the Republican base, the conservative base. So they feel that what's going on right now with the effort to quickly nominate and confirm a replacement for Judge Ginsburg, they believe that this is firing up their base. But what I'm seeing is that it's firing up Democrats a lot more than that. I heard a report last night that from Friday evening until last night, more than $70 million had come into the Democratic coffers for the coming elections. And I'm seeing that the more the Republicans do this, the more determined Democrats are to respond. I've said on previous programs, and other people have said this as well, that if the Democrats have made a mistake in the last several years, and this especially includes Barack Obama, he really believed that he could work with those across the aisle from him, and he did everything that he could do to reach out to his Republican opposition. He knew that there were Republicans on that side of the aisle that would never support him. He knew that. But he also believed that there were a number of other Republicans on the other side of the aisle, on that side of the aisle, that had love and respect for this country that exceeded or superseded politics. And he believed that he could work with those people, and that he could build a sense of bicameralism back in a government which is seriously, seriously divided. If he were with us now, he would begin to recognize that that possibility no longer exists. When I heard this morning that Mitch McConnell, excuse me, that I've got Mitch McConnell on the brain, and I apologize for that. Mitt Romney was going to support the president's efforts to put forth a quick nomination for the Supreme Court. I have to say that I was extremely disappointed in Mitt Romney. But and let me qualify that, because I have to say that I've been so proud of Mitt Romney in the last several months because of his willingness to be the only Republican to stand up in the Senate, to stand up against this president. And he had been governor of Massachusetts, my home state. And even though I didn't support him and I didn't vote for him, I have a kind of a warm feeling for him, because he's from my state. He represents the Senate from the state of Utah now, but he was governor of Massachusetts several years ago. And the irony of ironies is Mitt Romney was able to get through the legislature in Massachusetts a health care plan which Barack Obama used as the model for the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have desperately tried to suppress this information. But the fact of the matter is, the health care plan that Mitt Romney was instrumental in enacting as governor in the state of Massachusetts is in many ways almost a mirror copy of the Affordable Care Act as it was passed by the Obama administration. And because it was Obama's, the Republicans have declared war against it. And it appears with this pending nomination and confirmation before the election of a conservative replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it's clear that the Affordable Care Act is likely to fall before a 6-3 conservative majority on the court. It's next week, 1 week after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that the Trump administration will go to the Supreme Court to urge the destruction of the Affordable Care Act. Now, with this nomination in the offing, if it doesn't die now, it's likely to die after November 3rd during the hopefully lame duck session, between the time that Donald Trump loses on November 3rd and the time he leaves office on January 20th, 2021. So I've had a very positive feeling toward Mitt Romney. And then when he stood up and he was the only Republican member of the Senate to support removal of Donald Trump from office during the impeachment trial, I was very proud of him. And what that meant was that because I was so proud of him, I assumed that he would continue to vote and act in ways that I support. I fully expected him to come out in opposition to the president's determination to name a replacement and have that replacement confirmed before the November 3rd elections. I was surprised, I have to admit, when Susan Collins came out against it, because she raised all sorts of questions about things that Donald Trump was doing before, but in the end, she always came down and voted for him. And I expected the same thing this time. I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, when she came out just a day or two ago and said that she did not support the president's efforts to ram through a replacement for Judge Ginsburg. And then Susan Murkowski of Alaska did the same thing. They were two of the two Republicans that were expected to oppose Donald Trump and maybe to support the removal of office from Donald Trump. And many of us will remember the speech that Susan Collins gave on the floor of the Senate, in which she laid out all the things that President Trump had done wrong and said that she recognized and appreciated the idea that Donald Trump had done enough to be removed from office, but she was not going to vote to support that removal. Because, if you remember, she believed that he had learned his lesson. Well, he learned his lesson, all right. He learned his lesson that once he got over that hurdle, nobody could stop him. And he's been on a mad kick ever since. So I'm a little bit disappointed in Mitt Romney. Even the three of them, if they were the only ones, wouldn't have been enough because Vice President Pence would cast the deciding vote. It would take four Republicans to defect. And at this point, we have two. And this morning, Lindsey Graham announced that he was sure that the Republicans had the votes to make this go. And I was so disappointed, because I really expected more from some of those people. Rob Portman of Ohio being one. Senator Grassley being another one. Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, retiring senator, as another one. I really hoped that a number of these people would use this last opportunity, in some cases, to take a stand. And they didn't do it. So here we are. As I mentioned, Eugene Robinson wrote a piece, a column, in this morning's Washington Post. And I heard him interviewed on that column this morning. And because of things going on here, I haven't had the chance to read the post this morning, as I usually do before our programs. But Eugene Robinson made the case today that it looked like, and to him indeed, that Donald Trump had the votes to make this happen. And the debate, the media is now projecting one of two women as being Donald Trump's choice. The first one is Judge Barrett from Chicago. And the other one is a judge in the circuit court in Florida. Both of those are avowed conservatives. And there is some thinking that the one in Florida might be a little bit more moderate than the judge from Chicago, who is a fundamental Roman Catholic with seven children, is totally opposed to abortion. And I grew up Roman Catholic, and I can appreciate where she's coming from. She's obviously has strong feelings about right to life. One of her children was born with Down syndrome, and she knew it before the birth. She knew it during the pregnancy. And there were a number of points of view given her that she might think about terminating the pregnancy, and she refused to do it. And she brought the pregnancy to term, even though she knew that she was going to be dealing with a Down syndrome child. I respect that. I do respect that. But I don't respect the idea of imposing your views on other people. I don't. And I think that we're in a situation where that's what she's inclined to do. If anything bothers me about her, about Judge Barrett, it's that when Donald Trump in 2017 nominated Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court, he made a comment to people in his administration that, quote, "I'm saving Judge Barrett for Ginsburg," unquote. I think that's why most people believe that she's the front runner. But the fact that as early as 2017, Donald Trump was waiting and hoping that he would have an opportunity to replace Judge Ginsburg is extremely disturbing. It says a heck of a lot more about him than it does anybody else. But as Eugene Robinson said, what we've come to is a situation of exercise of raw political power. The Republicans, who are in danger of losing control of the Senate and losing the White House, are determined to plant their ideological preferences in a conservative Supreme Court. And the reality is, as we all know, that if you have a Supreme Court that is not divided, that does not depend on a swing vote between a four to four split, conservative and liberal, if you don't have that, but you have a 7-2 split on the court, or in this case, a 6-3 split, then what that means is that even though Chief Justice Roberts has begun to play the role of the swing vote that Justice Stevens used to play before the nomination and confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, the appointment of a conservative now by Donald Trump pretty much negates Justice Roberts. Even in some cases, Justice Roberts has shown an inclination to decide with the liberal wing of the court. But once you get the 6-3 split, it's not going to matter. I mean, let's face it, Justice Roberts is a conservative person. He's been all his life. But he's a jurist. He's an institutionalist. He respects the role of the court. He's concerned about the fact that the court has become and continues to become more and more political. That bothers him because that's not the role envisioned for the court. So when we say the split is going to be 6-3, now that Ginsburg is gone, we're including Roberts as one of the three. The liberals and Chief Justice Roberts, but the conservative ranks will now be strengthened 6-3. And when you have that ideological balance in favor of one side by that much, you run the risk of the court becoming weaponized. It can basically bring the rest of the federal government to its knees, irrespective of who controls the White House and who controls Congress. In other words, if the Supreme Court is organized and on a mission to do everything it can do to sabotage the other two branches because they're liberal, then essentially what has been and continues to be Donald Trump will continue to live after Donald Trump in the court. I think that's pretty much the way it is. Eugene Robinson said, and I agree with him so much, the reason I keep going back to this. He basically said that if the Republicans do this, then what they are basically saying is that they are putting their own ideological preferences ahead of the good of the nation. What that means is they are sacrificing the best interests of the nation to their own political preferences. In effect, they have declared war against the Democrats, against liberalism. And they have basically made it clear that they intend to use their control of one of the three branches of government to thwart as much as they can of government's platforms and policies. And what that means is sabotaging things like health care, like the Affordable Care Act. It'll be gone. And Eugene Robinson made the point this morning, and I'd like to reinforce it now, that if the Republicans are successful in getting the 6-3 majority, then that will be the end of the Affordable Care Act. And it's likely to be the end of Roe v. Wade and abortion on demand as well. But there's more. Social Security, food stamps, the SNAP program, the safety net. All of the things that Americans in trouble depend on from their government will be in jeopardy. This is war, political warfare. And therefore, if indeed the Democrats do win the White House in 2020, and also take control of the Senate from Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, they will have the power to pack the court, to increase the number of justices in order to offset and eliminate the conservative majority by being able to outvote it. Many will remember that Franklin D. Roosevelt tried to pack the court in 1937 because a conservative Supreme Court was threatening to strike down much of the legislation that became part of Roosevelt's New Deal program. And finally, by 1937, Roosevelt made the decision that he was going to basically use his power with his Democratic majority in the House to increase the size of the court in order to thwart the conservative opposition to the New Deal. Basically, what Roosevelt was threatening to do was politicize the Supreme Court. And the nation would have none of it. The nation would not stand for it. Even though the nation was in the middle of a depression, public opinion rose up in one voice to make it clear that they would not sit back and let the President of the United States do this. Ultimately, Roosevelt was forced to back down, and the Supreme Court remained pretty much the same number of justices. What did happen, however, is that a number of the conservative justices on the court had a change of mind and began to support Roosevelt's New Deal program to a certain, to a large degree. So many of the things that Roosevelt wanted to get through, he eventually got through anyway, even though he was unable to change the makeup of the court. What he proposed, I mean, I'm not going to get into all the details, but what he proposed was requiring that justices retire at the age of 70, which would have forced two or three of the more conservative judges on the court out to retire. And he was going to replace them with liberals who supported the New Deal. And he was prepared to add justices because the number nine is nowhere in the Constitution. It's totally a random number. At one point, it was seven. At one point in the nation's history, it was seven. So there's nothing magic about nine members of the Supreme Court. So already we're hearing from Democrats that if Donald Trump goes through with this, then the Democrats feel that they would have no choice but to increase the size of the court when they take over in January. That's the state of the political situation we find ourselves in today. And let me make one more comment, which is a little bit unrelated to that, but it's connected, because I think it's important. And that is that the number of coronavirus deaths has gone above 200,000 in this country. By far, we are experiencing more devastation from the coronavirus than any other nation in the world. By far. And I think the evidence is in that Donald Trump is responsible for a lot of this. Where am I going? As we struggle and debate and argue over the Supreme Court and over this nomination, Donald Trump loves it because it's taking 200,000 deaths off the front page. It was until Ruth Bader Ginsburg died Friday evening, it was pretty clear that Donald Trump was going to run for re-election on November 3rd against bearing the responsibility for 200,000 deaths and more than 6 million infections in this country from the coronavirus. Now, with the deaths of Judge Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg, all the attention has switched to the Supreme Court. And his determination to ram through a replacement for Justice Ginsburg before the election has become the focal point of conversation in this country, political conversation, which means that once again, Donald Trump has been able to divert or distract attention away from the things he doesn't want to own, even if he's the one that is responsible for the distraction. That's what he does. This action about replacing Justice Ginsburg is in part political. He would much rather have his base going into the election with a positive mission to support the conservative majority on the court than having to justify and explain 200,000 deaths and 6 million infections that the evidence suggests their president and their party caused. So the irony of this is that Justice Ginsburg's death has become, I think, a political advantage for Donald Trump. But as I mentioned earlier, while it's energizing Republicans, it's also energizing Democrats. I think, as I mentioned at the very beginning, I think a lot of it has to do with respect that Americans had for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But I also think that Americans 2 years ago, three years ago, in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation mess, were able to see what weaponizing the Supreme Court of the United States was like, and they don't like it. And they're mad. They're mad at what Donald Trump is doing and what the Republicans are doing, and they're determined to do something about it. And that's something that's new, I think. I think that indicates that the Democrats have moved off the dime, so to speak. The argument was, and has been since Obama was in the White House, that Democrats have tried to play the game the way the rules were written, while Republicans ignored the rules or totally, voluntarily, willfully broke the rules in order to win. In other words, Democrats were operating at a disadvantage against Republicans because Democrats were trying to make the system work while Republicans were trying to win. But I think that we've reached the point now with the Ginsburg death and the memory of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings haunting the nation that Democrats have finally said, enough of this effort to try to reach across the aisle and get these Republicans to come to their senses. They want to fight, let's give them a fight. And I have to say that that might be the only way to deal with this. And I'm not comfortable saying it, because I too have tremendous respect for the system that the founders created. But I think that this man's presidency brings such great danger to this system, to this political system of ours, to this government, from people that show absolutely no respect for it at all, that I think those who love this government have exhausted all other options. Because let's remember, the Republicans represent a minority in this country. The people, if they choose to exercise it, can control this whole situation. The issue has been getting them to the point where they would be willing to exercise it. I think that as of right now, they've reached that point. That's my spin or my read on what's going on. Like everybody else, I'm extremely disturbed. I'm worried. I'm depressed. I'll be honest. I'm a little bit depressed. I want to be optimistic because I usually am optimistic about almost everything. But it's hard. It's a tough day for the optimists. And I've reached the point where I'm willing to fight as well. And I'm kind of seeing that most Democrats are feeling much the same way. When you think of who we've lost in this country in the last couple of years in terms of voices, leading voices, Elijah Cummings, John Lewis, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Excuse me, I had a little bit of a coughing fit there. And a fourth one that I would include into this is John McCain. John McCain obviously was a Republican. We know that. But John McCain loved this country and he loved this government. And I'll never forget the thumbs down that he gave in the Senate chamber with Mitch McConnell standing there watching. On the proposal to kill the Affordable Care Act. I'll never forget that. I also have a very personal reason for including John McCain amongst the major political voices we've lost in the last few years. I've mentioned this some time ago. When my stepdaughter graduated from Arizona State University many years ago in Phoenix, the morning of her graduation, the family was all getting into the car to drive to the university for the graduation. And my stepdaughter's cell phone rang, and it was John McCain. And he was calling her to congratulate her on graduating from Arizona State University. And it just so happens that my stepdaughter's ex-husband, she is divorced, was on a plane to Phoenix. And John McCain was on the same plane flying back to Phoenix, to Arizona from Washington. He was from Washington, D.C. He was on his way home. And my stepdaughter's ex ended up in a conversation with John McCain on the plane. And McCain asked him, what was his business flying to Phoenix? And he said, I'm flying to Phoenix to attend the graduation of the only woman I've ever loved. And then he told John McCain a little bit about my stepdaughter. She was an older student. She had a family. She had raised her family. She had gotten her two children through college before she decided to go there herself. She was an employee at Arizona State for many years. That was her job. She was the administrative assistant in the School of Engineering at Arizona State University. And then she started to take classes, and she finally graduated. And the ex-husband said, we're not living together anymore. We had to give up the marriage. But at the same time, there's nobody in the world that I respect more than her. And from that conversation, on the morning of the graduation, John McCain called my stepdaughter in her driveway on the way to the commencement ceremony. I was so moved. I knew nothing about this. I was so moved. So, I felt so warm toward John McCain for doing this that I still remember it. It was years ago and I still remember it. But, so when I talk about the Elijah Cummingses and the John Lewises, I include John McCain in this. And the fact that President Trump lets no opportunity pass to demean the legacy of John McCain just makes me like John McCain more. So with that, we have about 10 minutes left in this hour. And again, I remind you that we're not going to be doing a second hour today because I do have an appointment. But we will be doing the full 2 hours tomorrow, as I mentioned. And Kevin Chanley will be with us for the two hours or as much of that time as we need. What I wanted to do is, and I've only got 10 minutes to do it, I'm not going to get into any details because I don't have time. But I was fortunate this past weekend, this past Sunday, to have a piece that I had written published in our statewide newspaper here, the Charleston Gazette, which is a statewide West Virginia newspaper. And this particular one was about the founders. More specifically, it was about Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. And what I set out to do in that article, and I'll give you the conclusion, and maybe we can, maybe one day next week, we can kind of look at the details of the article, because I think there's a lot in here. A number of my friends that and colleagues who have read this have commented that it's just chock full of historical information. It's, in other words, it's full of information, things that people probably don't know but should know, I believe. But what I'm doing is something that in the years that I've been doing this, I don't think that I can remember anyone who's done it, who's done this before. There may be people, I don't know. But if there are, they're not making a big thing of what they're doing. And I think if they are doing it, then what they're doing is a big thing. And they need to basically do more to highlight what they're doing. And that is to deal with the Federalist Papers not as individual papers and what they say about the Constitution of the United States, which all 85 papers were written in order to persuade the people, the voters of this country, to support ratification of the Constitution. That was the whole motive operandi behind the Federalist Papers. This was a strategy devised by Alexander Hamilton in New York. It was designed to get the Constitution ratified in the state of New York, which was Hamilton's state. And he had the very good fortune of being able to call for support on James Madison in Virginia. Because Virginia ratified the Constitution in late June of 1788. And once Virginia ratified, then Madison, at Hamilton's invitation, went to New York and, along with Hamilton, wrote many of the Federalist Papers. At the end of the day, Madison wrote 29 of the 85 papers. John Jay wrote about 5. The rest of them were written by Alexander Hamilton. And again, they were all designed to get the Constitution of the United States ratified. But what we've done with the Federalist Papers is look at them individually. That's our inclination. Too rarely do we see scholars or historians connect one paper with the other paper. I'm looking in this paper, in this particular piece, specifically at Federalist Number 9, written by Hamilton, and Federalist Number 10, written by James Madison. In Number 9, Hamilton makes reference to a number of innovations that have occurred in politics, which have made it possible for Republican government to flourish. Hamilton believed throughout his life that Republican popular government couldn't work. But he realized that the Constitution of the United States incorporated a number of alterations or changes in the structure of Republican government, thanks to James Madison, that would make Republican government workable. In the very next paper that was published in the state of New York, and then picked up and published in a number of other states as well, the very next Federalist paper, number 10, is written by Madison. And in number 10, Madison writes clearly with Hamilton's number 9 essay at his elbow. Because what he says in Federalist number 10 are the very same things that Hamilton laid out in number 9 without the detail, as being innovations that made representative government work, allowed representative government to work. Madison picked up on that and made reference to them in number 10. And for too long, historians have looked at Madison's number 10. It's clearly the feature Federalist paper of all 85. This is the one that everybody goes to first, is number 10. Because it's brilliant. There's no question it's brilliant. But almost never do people or historians give credit to Hamilton for the ninth Federalist paper, which is published right before number 10. Because in it, Hamilton praises many of the things that Madison features in number 10. So when I wrote this piece, I entitled it "To Reconcile Monarchy with Republicanism, Alexander Hamilton to James Madison, A Political Handoff." Because what I'm trying to suggest in that title is that Hamilton deserves a significant amount of the credit that has gone almost exclusively to Madison. And that's why we'll go into this. I think there's an awful lot to say about Hamilton, especially since Lin-Manuel Miranda came out with Alexander Hamilton the Musical. And suddenly a lot of Americans know about Hamilton who knew nothing about him before. So I think it's going to be worthwhile to go through this piece when we have more time. But we're within the 1 minute of the top of the hour now. But I did want to at least, you know, prepare you, if that's the proper word, for a discussion that will happen next week. Because I really do believe that this is a significant article. And I don't mean that because I wrote it. I mean it not because it contains my interpretation, such as that is. I think what makes it important is the content within it. Because there's an awful lot of information in it that people don't realize. And I understand why. I mean, my God, there's so many things going on now. How can you possibly know what was going on 270 years ago? But the fact of the matter is, there was a lot going on. And I think it's important to bring it to people's attention, because I think the result of it all is that Americans begin to have even more respect for the founders than they do now. And I don't think it's possible to give the founders more respect than they deserve. So with that, we've reached the top of the hour. We reached today the end of our program, an abbreviated version of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. I invite you to be back with us tomorrow at our regular time, 1 o'clock. Kevin Chanley will be our guest. Until then, I hope you have a wonderful rest of this beautiful, beautiful autumn Tuesday afternoon. Thank you.